This is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. When Dianne Feinstein returned to the Senate last week, Democrats, with an eye on the progress of their party's judicial nominees, breathed a sigh of relief. But her return has raised more concerns, as she's continued to exhibit signs of short-term memory loss. That's taken a few forms over the past couple of years, like asking the same question twice in a Senate hearing with the former CEO of Twitter. After her return to work, reporters who caught up with her at the Capitol said she appeared confused and denied that she had ever been absent. Feinstein herself says she is prepared to resume her duties with a lighter schedule as she recovers from the shingles virus. For some, the trailblazing senator has become a political problem for Democrats in a closely divided chamber of Congress. Others see a symbol of things to come, how our society struggles to deal with an aging population and the memory problems that threaten to swamp our long-term care system. I, and I venture to say many others, see a very relatable story unfolding. My family has dealt with the confusion and pain of addressing a loved one's memory loss. It's a fearful journey. You start scrutinizing things that they say or do, and you worry about any escalating signs of cognitive issues that could, someday, take them away from you. You also don't want to jump to conclusions or catastrophic thinking about what they're going through. And it's hard to know how to talk about any of this without overstepping or disrespecting the independent person that you know and love. I wanted to talk about all of this with an expert who helps families navigate these very tricky questions. Kelsey Wood is a dementia program specialist at Northwest Regional Council's Agency on Aging in Northwest Washington. And she joins me now. Hi, Kelsey. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Now, when we talk about memory loss or dementia, these words are pretty big catch-all terms. Mm-hmm. How well do these terms map with actual cognitive and medical conditions? What do they actually mean when we say words like memory loss and dementia?
Yeah, so I actually like using the term brain change a lot better than using the term memory loss, because dementia can look like memory loss, which is how most people think of it. But it can also look like things like changes in behavior, changes in personality, sleep disturbances. Those can all be symptoms of dementia. And dementia itself is an umbrella term. There's over 200 different types of dementia. The most common ones are Alzheimer's disease, vascular dementia, and dementia with Lewy bodies. But most people with dementia have multiple pathologies occurring at the same time. So when we say dementia, it's actually just referring to a set of symptoms.
And I want to get one thing clear off the top here. We are not trying to diagnose anyone from afar. Senator Feinstein is exhibiting some symptoms that people are calling short-term memory loss. But for somebody who is going through a brain change, as you call it, Kelsey, I mean, these can take many different paths, right? And we, as non-doctors and people who are not treating Senator Feinstein, there's no way to tell exactly what her brain change may be and what kind of issues she may be facing, right?
That's exactly right, yes.
One of the things we've seen over the past few years is that for folks who have somebody in their family going through a brain change, it's difficult to start that conversation. There are a lot of emotions that come up. There's a lot of fear of creating stigma or trying to take power away from that person. What do you advise people is the best way to start a dialogue when somebody that you love or somebody in your life may be facing a brain change?
Sure. So when I'm working with families that are maybe concerned about a family member who's exhibiting some symptoms of brain change, some behavioral change, just general concerning things, usually I advise them to start the conversation really early. Don't wait until something catastrophic happens to have that conversation. Be really specific about the changes that you've seen in the person, listing as many specific examples as you can give about things like driving or safety concerns. Make plans to go see a doctor together, offer to go with them, and do the screening yourself. My dream is that we live in a world where memory screenings are just as routine as blood pressure screenings or blood glucose monitoring, mammograms, colonoscopies. We just think of it as part of our preventative health care.
Are there any specific symptoms that people should be watching for to start that conversation about maybe getting a memory screening?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of misinformation about what is normal aging and what is more concerning memory loss. And we know that, you know, forgetfulness is a part of normal aging, you know, misplacing your keys every now and then, forgetting a name. That's typically not something too concerning. But when somebody is losing language for common items, when they're making poor decisions financially or otherwise that seem uncharacteristic for the person, those are the kind of things that we start to get a little bit more concerned about and encourage people to, you know, see a provider for.
When dealing with something like this, a brain change, memory issue, maybe cognitive decline, autonomy becomes this huge question in families. When does a caregiver or a family member need to step in to start making decisions for that person? How do you approach this question with your clients?
Yeah, that's a great question. Honestly, you know, what we see a lot of time is people wait too long, and then it becomes an issue of there's nobody has been listed in legal documents. And so people need to go through a really complex legal process called guardianship in order to be able to access the person's financial or healthcare decisions. And it really starts as a conversation. And if people can start as early as possible before they have any sort of, you know, memory related symptoms or things, because there's many conditions that can cause somebody to be unable to speak for themselves, to start early and pick who would they like to be making those decisions for them. And what kind of care would they like? Would they like to stay at home? Would they prefer to have in-home care? Would they prefer to go to a facility where, you know, there's a nursing staff available at all times? So having those conversations early and making those decisions before it comes time is really a great gift that you can give to your family and the people in your life that are important to you.
So yeah, that leads me to what about the person themselves who may be experiencing some symptoms, or maybe they're simply aging and they are starting to think about the possibility of facing some brain changes. What kinds of actions can they take proactively to try to set themselves up well and their families well for that aging process?
Absolutely. Doing some legal planning if you have access and resources to use an elder law attorney. That's a great resource to set yourself up financially. Doing some advanced care planning, so talking about end-of-life care and getting documents in place with your healthcare provider, with your family, with the people in your life that are important to you, and making sure that everyone knows what kind of care you would like, if especially if you have, you know, Alzheimer's disease runs in your family, or you've experienced that. And that can often be a really powerful way to start the conversation, is thinking about the experiences that you've seen and reflecting on, oh, you know, I really didn't like the way that Aunt Marge's end of life was handled. And I would really like my story to be different. And that can be a great jumping off point for starting those conversations.
What do you tell somebody or a family member when a diagnosis of a serious brain change has come down and they're feeling scared and maybe they're even feeling hopeless? What's your first message to somebody after they have gotten some medical diagnosis?
My first message to somebody who's newly diagnosed is you are not alone. There is a whole community of people that are living with brain change. There's a whole community of care partners who are ready and willing to, you know, welcome you with open arms. There's still ways that you can be a valuable member of our community. It may be a terminal diagnosis, but it is not the end of life. Life goes on after dementia. We know that people can live for a very long time after receiving a dementia diagnosis. There's no standard trajectory. So that in itself can be really frustrating for people, you know, that are trying to plan like, okay, how long am I going to be doing this care thing? Because it's not standard for everybody. And the journey is very different, but you don't have to do it alone. And there's lots of great community supports, you know, around dementia and memory loss that are willing to reach out to you and help you stay connected and stay involved.
What about the social stigma involved? I think that some people are embarrassed by their memory issues. They might themselves wish to hide and not connect with people who previously might have been a social support for them because they're embarrassed that they are experiencing these issues, or loved ones might want to maybe not bring this person around to as many different social events as before. How do you help people navigate the social stigma of memory issues?
Yeah, that's a great point, Libby, because the social stigma is so real. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we were referring to people as senile. I mean, we have all sorts of euphemisms in our culture around memory loss and brain change, and they can be really hurtful and really damaging. And I would encourage people to continue to be involved in life and community. And that is a way that we as a society can become more educated on how to be friendly to people with dementia, how to be welcoming to people with dementia, is actually interacting with people. And we know that isolation is actually detrimental to our cognitive abilities. That's one of the most devastating things that an older person can do, is becoming socially isolated or remaining socially isolated, because our brain craves those connections with others. You'll actually find that people are generally really forgiving. And one way to kind of ease into that, being around other people, if you haven't done it in a long time or you're worried, I don't know how this person with dementia is going to act in a public setting, is attending things like memory cafes or finding some dementia-friendly events near you where you're going to be around other people that get it. And they can provide you some tools for what do I do when I go out in public? What do we do when we, you know, go to dinner and, you know, I don't know what he's going to say to the server.
Again, we started this conversation with a description of the ways that Senator Dianne Feinstein's public short-term memory loss issues have become a national conversation about elder care, about autonomy, about whether an older person is able to do their job and to fulfill, you know, the voter's will that elected her. Again, we are not diagnosing anybody from afar here, but as a country right now and in the media, there's a lot of heated rhetoric, and there's a lot of, because it's politics, it immediately goes 0 to 60. And we see, you know, calls for Senator Feinstein to resign, accusations of elder abuse because she's staying in the job. Once again, Senator Feinstein says she wants to be here and that she can do the job. So do you have any final reflections on the ways that the national conversation is addressing not just this high profile situation with brain change, but the ways that we as a society address this issue and the ways that perhaps it can be harmful for having a holistic understanding of brain change?
Yeah. So if we start thinking about brain change as a spectrum, the way that we do many other things, and start thinking about it, it's not all or nothing, right? There's a spectrum. It's a journey. Things start out slow and may progress, and then for others, they may never progress. So it's not the same for every single person. So I think one of the fallacies that we've run into is that people compare their personal experience. A lot of us have really negative experiences because we've seen, you know, family members or friends that have been treated really poorly and end up in institutionalized settings. And we know that that's not the case for a lot of people living with, you know, brain change are in our communities and interacting with the public every day. One person's experience does not apply to all. And so thinking about every case as unique, I think, is a really powerful stance that we can take. And also recognizing the value of people living with brain change, that it does not mean that those things that have been always true about that person are all of a sudden irrelevant or disappear, because typically it's actually the short-term memory that disappears first, and those long-term things are retained.
And I think recognizing that they're still valuable members of society, I mean, that's such a basic concept, but somehow seems to have been lost here.
Yeah. And I think we're doing a huge disservice to ourselves as a community, not just for a person who's living with some brain change, but also for ourselves as a society, when we're taking people who are, they're experiencing some deficits in some areas, But that doesn't mean that they have nothing to give anymore. In fact, it couldn't be further from the truth. You know, I reflect back on my work with Indigenous elders in Alaska and those traditions that they had that were very ingrained in who they were as a person, even late into a disease process, they were still able to pass those traditions on to young people. And that's an opportunity that they wouldn't have been afforded if they would have been tucked away inside of a secure facility or something like that. It involves community life and dementia and brain change and memory loss. All of these things, they're not just a healthcare issue. It's a societal issue because it's the community that's providing the care for people most of the time. I think the AARP did a study and they said that they provide over $4 billion in care every year, which is astronomical. And these are people that are everyday people. It's, you know, people like you and me that have jobs and lives and families that are also caring for somebody who's living with brain change.
Yeah. And as an aging society, we are going to be increasingly addressing these issues. And I hope that we can do it with compassion and understanding of the nuance. Like you said, every single case is different. Kelsey Wood is a dementia program specialist at Northwest Regional Council's Agency on Aging. I really appreciate the conversation, Kelsey. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
As Kelsey mentioned, a lot of societal assumptions regarding brain change are starting to shift. For more on how that's playing out in the medical field, we called up Allison Lindauer, an associate professor of neurology with Oregon Health and Science University's School of Medicine. Lindauer also works at the Leighton Aging and Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, whose mission is to help people learn about and access memory care therapies. And she says one of the emerging trends in care is just how early people are accessing it.
We're learning that we have to diagnose Alzheimer's disease super early in the disease process in order to make important changes. So, for example, the newer drugs that are coming out are really only for people in the very, very early stages. And I think people are really learning that and they're knowing, okay, if I have a strong family history or if I'm starting to have some early symptoms, I really need to be assessed soon rather than waiting until much later in the disease process.
Lindauer says that as soon as there is concern about memory loss, that person should seek out a doctor. She admits most everyone loses their keys.
But if you lose your keys and you just kind of give up and can't really think about where you lost them, or you can't really do a search to find them, it doesn't make sense. Trying to problem solve and figure things out, that's an early sign that's concerning.
Lindauer says many signs of memory loss or dementia are subtle. If a child or neighbor comes up and mentions that your memory has changed or seemed a little off, she advises people take those tips very seriously. When it comes to medical advances for treating the condition, Lindauer says there has been significant interest in drugs like lecanemab.
These drugs are monoclonal antibodies. They are given intravenously at a clinic site. Those drugs were recently approved by the FDA for use in research-type settings.
But Lindauer is cautiously optimistic about these treatments.
They have some very worrisome side effects, and they're expensive. But what these newer drugs are doing is heightening the public awareness of the need for therapies for dementia.
Lindauer says that no matter what, diagnosing dementia is critical to accessing help for both families and the people with the condition. Because as with so many other medical issues, the earlier you catch it, the more you can do to care for it.
If they have dementia, we can start therapies. For example, we can give them some medicine, even in the later stages, those old standby drugs such as donepezil that might help some of those symptoms. And then finally, it's important that families have conversations about advanced care planning, even late in dementia. How do you want to be treated when your symptoms get worse? What do you want your end of life to look like?
Even though dementia is a progressive disease, Lindauer says that it's important to avoid something she calls therapeutic nihilism, the idea that nothing can be done for someone with the disease.
Some of my patients, I have them meet with a speech therapist who specializes in memory, or if they're having more trouble walking, I get them with a physical therapist. If they're having depressive symptoms, we treat that. I mean, there's lots that can be done even in the moderate and late stages.
Thank you once more to Allison Lindauer with Oregon Health and Science University's School of Medicine and the Leighton Aging and Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. Thanks for listening to Soundside. By the way, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.